You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, during its first year, Wisconsin's Ethics Commission investigated one alleged violation of ethics, campaign finance, and finance and lobbying laws. That's a slower pace than its predecessor, the Government Accountability Board. We'll talk with the GAB's former director about what's changed.
First, a new study shows that by the year 2050, the percentage of solar energy worldwide will be three times higher than originally projected.
Greg Nemeth is associate professor at UW-Madison's La Follette School of Public Affairs. He worked on that study and he joins us now. Greg, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
Well, let's get a before and after. We know solar energy is on the rise around the world. What did we used to think it was going to look like by 2050 or so?
Well, I mean, one thing we noticed in our study is that, you know, we're looking at long-term energy planning, how to get an energy system that's cheap, that's clean and reliable. And the technologies that were being picked up in these models, which are simulations of how the world might work out, tended not to include solar energy. And so we started thinking that seems strange because if you look around the world, if you look on the ground, there's a lot of solar energy going in. So we went back to the forecast. We looked back over 15 years and looked at what people predicted would happen to solar energy 5 years out. And it was consistently undercounting how much solar there actually was. And even the most optimistic forecasts of solar, and they're, you know, these are forecasts by places like Greenpeace that were advocates for solar.
They want solar.
They were missing off and always in the same direction, always missing by predicting too little solar compared to what actually happened. And so we, in our study, we tried to look into not only documenting that we're kind of missing it, but then look into why.
Yeah, so it sounds like solar energy consistently is getting cheaper over time, faster than anybody expects it to.
Right. Yeah, and that's the biggest driver. So in terms of our whys, why did we underestimate solar's potential? The first is there's this learning curve mechanism that seems to be happening. And the basic idea is that the more you build of it, the cheaper it gets. And there's real reasons for that. You could get economies of scale by building big factories. People that are installing solar learn how to do it better as they perform more and more installations. And so those are real effects, and we see. And that was happening at a faster rate than people expected. So that was one reason, the learning curve. A second reason is that the policies that were put in place to create incentives for people to adopt solar were much more effective than people expected. And then third, people seem motivated by non-financial incentives. So the idea of having a green roof or having a solar panel as having other attributes other than saving you on your electric utility bills, I think those were underestimated as well. So there's kind of three big reasons. But what you mentioned, that solar is getting cheaper faster than we expect, is the biggest driver.
So as you look out into the future, where do you see solar energy going over the next, say, 20, 30 years?
Yeah, I mean, 20 or 30 years, it's going to play a bigger role than I think most people expect. And that's kind of our key point in this study. But I think there's also more near-term implications that people be maybe more interested in, maybe more relevant. So, you know, one of the things that's happening with solar continuing to get cheaper is it's forcing everybody to play catch-up. So it's forcing the grid, the infrastructure, to start to find ways to accommodate this resource that's different. It's distributed. It's on people's houses. It's not central. It only produces electricity when the sun shines. So the grid has to catch up. Regulation has to catch up. For the most part, we have a regulation of electricity in the U.S. that was designed in the 1930s, usually updated in the 1990s in some places. But that needs to be modernized as well, as do utility business models as well. So the cheap solar keeps forcing us to kind of reassess our assumptions. And just on a personal level, so I had today my first class of the semester on energy policy, and I made the point that when I present slides and I present data and information, there's no way I can any longer present the same slides that I presented last year because they'll be out of date. They'll be misleading about what the decisions are, and some of the perceptions that people have, even from a couple of years ago, are no longer valid. So cheap solar is forcing everybody to catch up, and I think in the next 5 to 10 years, that's where the real challenge will be.
Right, and I want to spend some time on those near-term challenges,
yeah.
But there's some pretty stark numbers that you have in the report by 2050. Did I see something like 30 to 50% of the energy mix?
It could be.
Could be solar
yeah.
energy. And that's
yeah.
huge. And I mean, are you talking just electricity production or energy?
No, that's energy. Right. So, I mean, you can use solar is available all around the world. There's almost an unlimited resource in terms of the amount of sunlight hitting the Earth. There's challenges that we can talk about, but in terms of the size of the resource, where it's available, and the flexibility, you know, you're producing electricity, which, you know, 5 or 10 years ago, that might have been limited to people's houses and businesses. But now we're talking about using electricity for industrial processes and for transportation, for driving. So that's a big change. And that's how you get to really big numbers.
We're talking about the future of solar energy with Greg Nemeth, associate professor at UW-Madison's La Follette School of Public Affairs. He looked at this study saying, hey, we keep consistently underestimating the growth of solar energy. Now, let's get into some of those challenges. You mentioned how we distribute power. Right now, we have a system. We produce a lot of power here at the coal plant or the natural gas plant or the nuclear plant, what have you, and then gradually let it fan out into the community. Solar is not the opposite, I guess, but very, very different. What would we have to change to make that work optimally?
Good. So it's different in two ways from the way we've had power plants, you know, for the last 100 years here. One is it's distributed. So we've got lots of small power plants all over the place. And two, it's not dispatchable. So we can't just turn on the solar electricity when we need it. We have it when it's sunny, and we know that that comes and goes. There's seasonality, there's daily variations, and there's clouds. And so some of those things are easy to forecast and some are not, but that's different. So the grid has to adapt to accommodate that. And so there's a few ways, there's been lots of work done on how you could get to a grid that's more flexible. That seems to be the key word. So one way is you have storage. So you have ways of storing electricity, which to date was something I used to say in my class 5 years ago is something for the long-term future, but it's not affordable now. So it's not something we can kind of rely on. That's not true anymore. Now we've got large-scale grid storage happening in lots of places for important clients. And that also keeps getting cheaper. So having storage in the grid, that helps with solar. Another way is to have demand, so people's decisions about when to use electricity, be more responsive to when electricity is available, and maybe by pricing it differently. So a more price responsive grid could make a big difference. And then more transmission is ways that people or countries that have installed a lot of solar have managed some of that intermittence as well. So there's ways and technologies that themselves are evolving and improving that will help us accommodate some of the challenges of a pretty different type of power source.
So then another big change would, if we're going to use this electricity in different ways, would be to take things that we currently do with a liquid fuel, oil or gas, or a fossil fuel, I guess, throw coal in there too, and do it with electricity. And obviously cars are part of that story. Yeah. Is that something, are we nearing a tipping point where we're going to see more of that to harness that electricity from the sun?
You know, the story of solar getting cheap is a really interesting one that I'm actually writing a book about now. One of the striking aspects of that is that a lot of the characteristics of solar now apply to electric vehicles. We're talking about a technology that has some spillover from the information technology industry. So in the case of electric vehicles, the batteries that come from cell phones and computers, those are rapidly decreasing in costs. That's similar to solar. And a part of that is because the massive economies of scale of building large factories to produce lots of batteries. And there's something about the modular aspect of it. We're not talking about having to install one gigantic power plant that might cost $1 billion or several $1 billion. We're talking about, you know, one car at a time. And so there's this scalable adoption that I think is part of the solar story that could also happen with electric vehicles. So I'm pretty, I guess optimistic is the word, but even more objectively, just expecting a lot of change in the electrification of vehicles. So yeah, I think that that's a place where solar could play a big role, the electrification of vehicles.
If we sat you down with some policymakers, state legislators, city officials, maybe economic planners, what do you want them to hear from this report?
My main takeaway for them is that we now have cheap solar. So our perceptions, even a couple of years ago or 5 years ago, that solar is a technology for the future and it's too expensive, are no longer true. So we now have cheap solar. And second, that it gives us a huge opportunity. It's a gift, you might say. And in my book, I make the point that it's a gift from collaboration around the world. But it's a gift that we shouldn't squander. And I think it's really up to us how we use this technology of cheap, clean energy that we can make reliable with a flexible grid and use it for lots of different activities that will improve people's lives. So how we use it is going to make a big difference. And how we deal with the financing of it, new utility business models, regulation of it, and building infrastructure to accommodate it, that's all things that we need to do to take advantage of this opportunity.
As we start to wrap up, I think people might be listening and thinking, that's great for Nevada with lots of reliable sunshine. Is this really a difference maker in a place like Wisconsin?
Certainly. You can produce more electricity out of a solar panel in a sunny place. And the cheapest solar in the world right now is happening in places like you said, Nevada, the southwest of the U.S., but also places like Mexico and Chile in the Middle East. So that's where the cheapest solar is. If you look at where the most solar is being installed, until recently, you would have said Germany. That's no sunnier than Wisconsin. I've spent a lot of time there. The biggest market for solar now, not the biggest producer of solar panels, the biggest consumer of solar panels is now China. That's also a place that doesn't have anything on us in terms of the amount of sunlight. So we're getting to the point where solar is cheap enough that even in a place like this, we can have cost-effective solar. And you're already seeing it. So we're having community solar in Madison. We're having big installations going up, such as up in Point Beach and other commercial facilities as well.
Greg, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Great. Thank you. Good to be here.
That's Greg Nemeth, Associate Professor at UW-Madison's La Follette School of Public Affairs, talking about his research on the future and actually the present of solar energy production.
A recent report shows that the Wisconsin Ethics Commission investigated one alleged violation of ethics, campaign finance, and lobbying laws in its first year of operation.
According to reporting by the Wisconsin State Journal, that puts the commission at a far less active pace than its predecessor, the Government Accountability Board, based on data from recent years.
Kevin Kennedy is the former director and general counsel of the Wisconsin Government Accountability Board, and he joins us to unpack the details of the commission's report. Kevin, thanks for being with us.
It's good to be here. Thank you.
Well, a new report shows that the Wisconsin Ethics Commission investigated only one alleged violation in its first year in operation. What do you make of that number, one?
Well, obviously one seems like a pretty low number. It's better than none. But, I mean, sometimes you have to put it into perspective. I mean, Wisconsin is not a state that is known for a lot of ethical issues, but generally campaign finance and lobbying issues have often driven investigations by the former Ethics Board and the former Government Accountability Board, as well as the former State Elections Board.
And by comparison, it's not an apples-to-apples comparison, the Government Accountability Board conducted 17 over a longer period of time, looks like about 3 years. The pace, though, seems to be slower. Is it a fair comparison to look and say the Ethics Commission is moving at a slower pace than the GAB?
I'm not sure it's entirely a fair comparison. I mean, there's a lot of changes. I mean, when the legislature chose to eliminate the Government Accountability Board, I mean, there was a conscious decision to really rein in the independent nature of that agency and channel it. In doing that, they also revised the campaign finance law, something that, you know, the former Elections Board and the Government Accountability Board had been advocating for quite a while because it was inconsistent with a lot of court decisions. So as a result, there's probably some leeway in that. There's also a lot more, a lot of things that were contrary to law before 2016 are no longer problems. Coordination of campaign activity between outside groups who are acting independently of the candidate and candidates, for example, was always a big issue for giving advice and for looking at possible transgressions. That's changed. There also might be, you know, some reluctance for people to file complaints on the new commission, not knowing exactly, you know, how they are going to operate. But so it's a slightly different culture. The other thing is that you know, the Government Accountability Board, fortunately for Wisconsin, was presiding during a very tumultuous period of time. So you had a very independent agency characterized by trained decision makers, former judges, all of whom had a nonpartisan background, dealing with, you know, the events from 2011 to 2016 that were very, very contentious. you know, the everything surrounding Act 10, the exit of Democratic senators, the recalls, statewide recount, that generated an awful lot more activity during that time period than what we saw in 2016.
Another change, talking about things that are different now. Now subjects are notified when there's a complaint, and it sounds like they have the chance to respond in writing. Do you think that could also reduce the number of investigations?
It could. It's not that subjects weren't notified in the past. It's just that some investigations, whether it's, you know, with a watchdog agency or whether it's with other types of law enforcement, oftentimes aren't providing notice, but that is one issue. Again, I think, you know, we're dealing with new laws in the area of campaign finance and new administration, so I think it people to get involved. And I think one of the things that often isn't looked at in terms of both the former Ethics Board and Elections Board, the GAB, and now the Ethics Commission, is that a lot of their work was very proactive in training people, reaching out to them, and making sure that they knew, that the regulated community knew that they could provide advice, informal and full. And, you know, that's probably one of the most what happens during, you know, a given work period for the commission and for its predecessor agencies, is making sure that the regulated community has confidence to say, hey, is this okay to do? Or please give me some direction. I have these kind of problems. And that cuts down a lot on possible violations of the law.
Now, Assembly Speaker Robin Voss has weighed in on this report and this number that we've been talking about, one from the new Wisconsin Ethics Commission. And he has said the commission's success should not be judged based on the number of investigations, but whether violations were prevented and the laws were followed. Do you agree with that assessment about the function of the board, of the commission?
I agree that that's one factor. On the other hand, you know, one of the things that led to the demise of the government, of the, not the Government Accountability Board, but what led to the demise of the former Ethics Board and Elections Board, was that those agencies, which were really not conducting investigations. The caucus scandal was part of what led to the creation of the Government Accountability Board, was the idea that neither the Ethics Board or the Elections Board was proactive in its engagement with what was commonly known as a practice throughout the Capitol, that people were using state resources beneath the Capitol dome for campaign purposes. And it really took from the inside to squeal and go to the press before you got action by district attorneys and by the Ethics and Elections Boards.
We're talking with Kevin Kennedy right now, former director and general counsel of the Wisconsin Government Accountability Board, joining us to talk about the first report issued by the new Wisconsin Ethics Commission. And Kevin, what would you say if someone has a concern, they see this number one investigation, and they're worried that this new commission will not have as robust a profile in Wisconsin, as active a role as the Government Accountability Board. Is that a fair concern, or is it too early?
You know, investigations are going to be generated because there is wrongdoing, and I think Speaker Voss had a point, and it was one I made earlier, that, you know, really one of the primary roles of these agencies is to cultivate an atmosphere where the regulated community feels confident to seek direction and advice rather than either go out on their own you know, I mean, that sort of fosters behavior, good behavior within the regulated community. I mean, we don't have to go too far away from Wisconsin to look to see where, you know, people are very cynical about the integrity of their elected officials, but Wisconsin, most of the fights tend to be about the political positions they stake out. There's a concern about the influence of money, but it's really not so much about people's personal gain or enriching their lifestyles with that, as much as it is a real contention over issues or the role that money plays in influencing those issues.
As the years go by, what will you be looking at to be a benchmark about whether the new Wisconsin Ethics Commission is working and doing its job as a watchdog agency?
Well, I think it'll be really trying to get a sense of the perception by the public, perception by the regulated community, as to whether or not there's a sense that Wisconsin's elected officials and high appointed officials are acting appropriately. I mean, we really saw that in early 2000 with the caucus scandal, that was a concern. We saw that during the very tumultuous time that the GAB was enforcing and administering the laws, that there were concerns. And there was a lot of political issues there, but it really isn't so much measuring all of the investigations, but obviously if it stays at one every year, you're going to have to say, are we really that well behaved? Or are we just not looking closely enough at the actions of those people trying to influence government or those people who are government officials?
Kevin, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're very welcome.
Kevin Kennedy is the former director and general counsel of the Wisconsin Government Accountability Board. He joined us to talk about details of the first report issued by the Wisconsin Ethics Commission. It and the Wisconsin Elections Commission replaced the Government Accountability Board last year.
Coming up, our next guest says the U.S. economy could take a hit if people protected under the DACA program are at risk of being deported. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow morning after 8, join Joy Cardine and her guests for this edition of The Week in Review. They'll look at the latest on the state budget deal, the federal debt ceiling, the end of DACA, and other top stories from state and national news. That's tomorrow morning after 8 here on the Ideas Network.
Now, Attorney General Jeff Sessions stuck with the legal arguments for the Trump administration's decision to end the consideration of deferred action for childhood arrivals, or DACA. But during his argument, he said that there was an economic component as well.
It also denied jobs to hundreds of thousands of Americans by allowing those same illegal aliens to take those jobs.
If the Obama-era policy is repealed, it could impact more than 750,000 people who were brought to the country illegally as children. And according to the report released by the Center for American Progress and the pro-immigration group Forward.us, has found that the repeal of DACA won't necessarily promise more jobs, could actually have a severe impact on the U.S. economy.
Tom Javits joins us now. He's vice president of immigration policy at the Center for American Progress, a progressive think tank based in Washington, D.C. Tom, thanks for joining us today.
Sure. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, let's start with that premise from the attorney general. DACA made these 800,000 people protected eligible to get jobs. Those jobs could have gone to citizens. So ultimately having them here hurt those citizens. What do you make of that argument?
Yeah, I mean, that's the same sort of zero-sum argument that you often hear from immigration restrictionists and Senator Sessions, or Attorney General Sessions, when he was Senator Sessions, was the loudest voice in Congress for that position. But it's just not borne out by the facts. Economists of all stripes, conservative, liberal, progressive, Democratic, Republican, conservative economists, have found, looking at immigration generally, that immigrants are a net positive for the economy and that by being both economic producers and also consumers, they help to generate growth. And so, you know, one thing we know from this particular population is that DACA recipients are actually heavily concentrated in industries like education and health services that have an unemployment rate that's even lower than the very low unemployment rate in the nation as a whole. And so there's no reason whatsoever to believe that, you know, there's a glut of unemployed middle school science teachers and math teachers out there who would step forward and take the kinds of jobs that these DACA recipients have been filling every single day for the last 5 years.
Suppose things go on as they are now. DACA is phased out. People currently protected are at risk of deportation. How do you see that affecting the economy?
Well, the impact would be dramatic. We actually worked with a couple of economists about a year and a half ago to study what the impact would be of removing all unauthorized immigrant workers from the economy. At the time, to be honest, it was something of a thought experiment, but I think the value of that study has been paying dividends. Looking at the method that was developed by those economists, which has been published now in a working paper series that's reviewed by fellow economists and has been very well regarded, we looked at what the impact would be of ending DACA and removing the approximately 700,000 DACA recipients who currently are in the workforce. We know that about 91% of DACA recipients are now in the workforce. And the impact would be stark. You'd see a loss over about a decade of about $460 billion in national gross domestic product. Because DACA recipients are present in every single state around the country and are present in every single industry, the impact would not be felt only in some place. It'd be felt everywhere. So Wisconsin, for instance, there are nearly 8,000 DACA recipients in Wisconsin, and the state would lose about $500 million in annual GDP if the DACA recipients who are in Wisconsin, who are currently in the workforce, were removed.
As a job seeker looking at this, could someone say, okay, if there are fewer people competing for this pool of jobs, that makes my labor more valuable, my wages could go up in this case? Is there an economic argument for individuals who might see some benefit here?
No, I mean, again, even looking at a much larger population of the unauthorized generally, where you have 11 million undocumented immigrants in the country and about 7 to 8 million who are in the workforce, all economic studies show that the impact on wages is at best negligible, or at worst, essentially negligible. There's for the unauthorized immigrant population generally, there is not really much competition. It's more of a complementary relationship. And for DACA recipients in particular, again, like I said, you see them concentrated in industries that have even lower unemployment rates than you see in the national economy more generally. But the other thing about this is, and I think this is what's often lost in the immigration debate, is that individuals, immigrants, are not just workers who are producing and are in jobs, but they're also consumers as well, right? And so when you have 800,000 individuals who are in the workforce, who are going to school, who are going to university, who are renting apartments, who are buying houses, we know that about, I think, about 15% of DACA recipients has purchased a house. They're generating economic growth for the country, for their communities. They're paying state and local taxes. All of this is helping to create an economy that's moving forward and allowing for the creation of additional jobs. And so we don't actually see a trade-off of that sort when you look at the broader immigration issue or even at the more narrow DACA population in particular.
There are concerns that as baby boomers more and more leave the workforce and retire, we might actually have worker shortages in some areas. I mean, can we fix some of that with immigration?
Yeah, I mean, that's a critically important question and something that I think never really gets talked about. I mean, I when I looked at that, at the images from Charlottesville and looked at the marches taking place around the Confederate monument, the chants that really struck me were the "you will not replace us" chants, not just because they were so clearly targeted at Jews and targeted at people of color and targeted at immigrants, but because actually, speaking from an economics perspective, this country and its future growth is counting on immigrants and their children to replace the millions of boomers who are retiring from the economy, from the workforce all the time. The National Academy of Sciences did a study last year in which they found essentially that in the current decade, but for immigrants and their children, we would have a negative working age population growth over that period of time. And in the decade to come, the only reason we're going to have not a negative one, the only reason we're not going to shed, I think, about 8 million workers from the working age population is specifically because of immigrants and their children. The work of these people, the benefits they will be producing for our economy, the taxes they will be paying, and Social Security taxes, is precisely what is going to allow us to keep our commitment to older Americans who are retiring out of the workforce today.
Can you talk about the impact of immigrant workers who are not currently under DACA? There's concern that because they're in such a precarious position, they will work for lower wages, they can be subject to wage theft, they have no workplace protections, and so some employers are turning them for cheaper labor when they could be and should be paying people higher wages.
Yes, that is a complicated issue. I mean, it is definitely the case that when individuals gain legal status, they gain the ability to more easily complain about their working conditions and their suppressed wages, and that can then be beneficial. So one issue for that, frankly, is we've got in this country, unfortunately, a dying labor movement, and we have seen that the country's disparities of income inequality have been at their lowest when the labor movement has been at its strongest. And so that's, in some ways, that's just a general symptom of a much larger problem in this country. But specifically, again, I think there's no question that there is both wage theft that takes place and some abusive conditions that affect undocumented workers, and frankly, many of the U.S. citizens and employment authorized immigrant workers who work in those same factories and those same plants. That's why we need, frankly, broader reforms that would actually allow more of these people to gain some additional power and gain some additional protections so they can better bargain for their for better working conditions and wages, and that would then lift the boat for all.
Very briefly, as you wrap up, we've seen a lot of business leaders speak out against this change. Do you think that they'll have an impact on what Congress ultimately does?
You know, I spent 6.5 years working for the House Judiciary Committee, and I know that a couple things. I know, one, that there are absolutely members on both sides of the aisle who understand this issue well, who want to find a responsible solution. I also know from my years working there that things began to deteriorate over time. What I think the significance of these business leaders coming out, of faith leaders, including evangelical leaders, of hundreds upon hundreds of university presidents, including the University of Wisconsin system, coming out in support of this, is that it can actually create the political will and the political space for those members who want to get to yes to finally get to yes. Congress has
and we have to leave it there. Thanks to Tom Javits from the Center for American Progress, looking at the economic impact of the DACA repeal. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We learned that this week the private payrolls in Wisconsin grew by 1.2% in a one-year period from March of 2016. Companies added more than 27,000 jobs, and that puts Wisconsin 30th in the nation in private sector job creation.
The numbers come from the Federal Bureau of Labor Statistics and its quarterly census of employment and wages. Economists consider this the gold standard of job metrics.
Brian Jacobson is digging into that report now. He's an associate professor of business administration at Wisconsin Lutheran College. He's also an asset strategist for Wells Fargo Asset Management. Brian, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, so companies added jobs in Wisconsin, but our private sector job growth didn't keep up with the national average of 1.7% over a year. What do you make of that?
Yeah, in Wisconsin, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics numbers, going from March 2016 to March 2017, the job growth in Wisconsin in the private sector was only around 1.2%. So that is well below the national number of 1.7%. Yeah, keep in mind these numbers are a little dated. To make sure that they're of high quality, for this, the Bureau of Labor Statistics oftentimes takes a long time in accumulating all the information. This is from the quarterly census of employment and wages. From unemployment insurance claims that a lot of employers have to file. And so, you know, it takes a long time to get this data in, but it's very comprehensive. And so that's one of the really nice things about it. But given that it is a little dated, it's important to remember that the first quarter of 2017 was actually kind of a letdown from an economic perspective. It was a slowdown, and the slowdown started in the fourth quarter of 2016. It continued into 17. We saw the automobile manufacturing really kind of drifted lower. Maybe some of these incentive programs that auto manufacturers are having aren't having the same stimulative effect on demand like it has. And so we did see a bit of a slowdown in economic activity. But thankfully, looks like as we are in the third quarter, things are looking a little bit brighter.
Now, in this report, Wisconsin ranks 30th nationally, pretty low down the list there. Is this bad news for job creation?
You know, the way I look at the rankings, it can fluctuate, you know, month to month, year to year. But if you put it in the context of, say, population growth, to be ranked 30th actually is pretty good since, in terms of population growth since 2010. So according from the 2010 census to about July 2016, Wisconsin ranked number 38, right? So when job growth is outpacing population growth, that's not a bad thing. It's probably, you know, one of the many reasons why the unemployment rate in Wisconsin is materially lower than what it is for the national average. But when you look at it, let's say, in terms of economic output, so for the whole U.S., you can measure gross domestic product. That's the market value of the final goods and services that are produced. You can also do that on a state-by-state basis. And on that basis, Wisconsin ranks number 20th. So, you know, relative to population growth, the employment numbers are actually not that bad. Relative to the size of the economy, the output per year that we're generating here, it could be a little better.
And relative to our neighbors, Illinois, Minnesota, Michigan, how do we look?
Yeah, in terms of the actual employment gains in Minnesota, they've been doing quite well, but their population growth has also been better. Michigan, their growth in employment was around 1.9 to 1.2%. A lot of that, as you can imagine, was driven by somewhat of a rebound from the March 2016 to March 2017 with auto sales. And so they're probably going to see a bit of a tapering off in the growth rate because auto sales are actually declining on an annualized basis here. Relative to Illinois, we did better, but our population growth is slightly better than Illinois', and our football team is also better. So, you know, that certainly helps.
You've talked about some of the silver linings in context. Are there areas looking at this report that you can point to and say, okay, there are some things here that Wisconsin is doing right?
I think that if you look at the breakdown by industry, you'll see that natural resources and mining, that employment growth was around 4.4% year-on-year. Construction was up 3.5%. And even like leisure and hospitality, that was up 2.2%. So those areas were looking pretty good. What sort of dragged on the headline number, manufacturing employment year-on-year basis was only up, a fraction of a percent. Employment in the information technology area was down 1.2%. So you do have this interesting dynamic where some industries are doing pretty well. You know, I'd point to construction, natural resources and mining, leisure and hospitality, and others are not. They seem like either they're just kind of treading water, and in some cases, a few of them are dipping a little bit. So, you know, from that perspective, just in terms of the jobs numbers, there's a lot of diversity in terms of the employment gains across industries. But when you look at the wages, those are actually doing fairly well. Aggregate wages year on year in Wisconsin, so the total wages that were paid, increased about 7.7%. So, you know, that's not too bad. So even if we aren't seeing the employment gains, at least it looks like for the economy as a whole, wages are doing better than inflation.
Now, unemployment in Wisconsin, it's been hovering around 3.2, very low, not a lot of movement there. What role does that play in all this?
Yeah, the unemployment rate is very low, and, you know, there's also this kind of more national, almost kind of conundrum, people scratching their heads as to how low can it go. We have, at the nationwide level, about 4.4% unemployment, but maybe that's actually not a good picture of what's called labor market slack, the number of people who are actually able to work. They use fairly technical definitions for calculating the unemployment rate. So in order to count as unemployed, you actually have to be actively looking for a job. So there are some people who maybe they gave up, and you have to be looking for a job within the last 4 weeks. So if you gave up 5 weeks ago, you're not counted as unemployed, even though, well, according to even a common sense definition, you're unemployed. So, you know, the low unemployment rate, I don't read too much into that. I think it can go lower. It can go higher. It's a very imperfect read as far as labor market health. I like to see that employment are the gains in the numbers more than enough to offset population growth. Are wages increasing at a faster pace than inflation? But then where almost most states are falling short is in terms of the number of people who are employed for the entire population, so something called the employment to population ratio. Nationally, that has begun to tick up a little bit, but it's still 2 percentage points lower than what it was before the global financial crisis, right? And we're already 10 years past when that sort of calamity started taking place.
We're talking to Brian Jacobson right now, Associate Professor of Business Administration at Wisconsin Lutheran College, and we're talking about the latest private sector job creation numbers here in Wisconsin. And Brian, what kind of policies do you think Wisconsin should have on the books that would favor job creation?
I think that some of the policies as far as, you know, creating a more standardized tax environment, I think that can sometimes help, where if you have an extra level of complexity to the tax code, so you have it at the federal level and then you have it at the state level, you know, to what extent are these synchronized with each other? And for a long time, Wisconsin's tax code, you know, it didn't really allow for certain deductions that were allowed at the federal level, and maybe that was serving as a deterrent to job creation. You know, but these are things on the margin. So, you know, from a policy perspective, you know, simplifying the tax code, I think, is everybody always is in favor of that, perhaps except for accountants and lawyers who, you know, make money by through the complexity of it. But from a policy perspective, then investing in education, that tends to help making neighborhoods safe and desirable to live in. But I'm not sure if there's really much policy can do about slow population growth. You know, if you look at where have the big economic gains been over the last few years, it's been in those areas where there's been a lot of population growth. I really don't know what, you know, they can do at the policy level to promote population growth in Wisconsin.
Now, we've been hearing a lot about a possible Foxconn deal, which would bring, looks like, two facilities, production facilities, to the state of Wisconsin. Would you expect that, once it comes to fruition, to give Wisconsin a big bump when it comes to jobs?
Oh, it could. You know, just mathematically, if you think about these, if they employ an additional at one facility, say, you know, 13,000 people or whatever it's going to be, that will show up in the numbers as a one-time increase. But then will it also result in, you know, other companies locating closer by because of supply chains and the such? What sort of rules are going to be changed in order to, you know, attract Foxconn? Will those rules also be applied to potential new entrants or people to relocate to Wisconsin? You know, so there's all sorts of unsettled questions on this. You know, the economist John Kenneth Galbraith once said that when it comes to forecasting, economists make astrologers look good. I think there's a little bit of truth to that, is to, you know, as far as trying to project out what would be the impact from this is somewhat of anybody's guess.
So speaking of guessing, any ideas what we can expect, trends you're seeing maybe for the next report?
Yes, so I do think that on the next report we're going to see a decent rebound, and it's mainly because we actually saw a national rebound in terms of economic activity. So again, this report was from covered March 2016 to March 2017, and a lot has happened since then. There was a lot of what some people called soft data based on surveys and the such, suggesting that, well, you know, businesses, consumers, they're feeling pretty good, but the hard data, you know, vehicle sales numbers, retail sales numbers, so things that are more measured in dollars and cents, those are looking pretty weak in the first quarter. But it did rebound in the second quarter, and it looks like that's actually being handed off to a pretty decent continuation of that rebound in the third quarter. So I would expect that these numbers, when you know, we look at them in another few months here, that they're going to start looking a little bit better.
Brian, thanks a lot for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Brian Jacobson is an associate professor of business administration at Wisconsin Lutheran College. He's also a multi-asset strategist for Wells Fargo. He was helping us interpret the new data from the Federal Bureau of Labor Statistics on private sector job growth in Wisconsin. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, a faith leader shares his perspective on DACA and deportation. A guest tells us why we should do more to reuse materials from abandoned buildings and build new buildings with a long-term plan for how they'll be taken down. And on Food Friday, it's apple season, and our guest shares great ways to cook and bake with apples, from the traditional pies and cobblers to delicious savory entrees. That's coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.